This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 18th of March, these are our main stories. The International Criminal Court issues an arrest warrant for President Putin, accusing him of the war crime of unlawfully deporting thousands of children from Ukraine to Russia. Russia has condemned the ICC move as outrageous. There are fresh concerns about the strength of the banking system. Plus,
how many of these labs are there? What are they working on? Who are they funded by? To map this space and get a sense of what the field looks like.
Should there be greater scrutiny of the big rise in the number of biolabs? Also in this podcast, police in Thailand are to be subject to random spot checks on their mental health and...
There is a moment right now where Indian docs, especially in the last few years, have done very well. Filmmakers have gone and really learned the ropes in terms of how to work the industry.
After a bumper night at the Oscars, is the documentary-making sector in India experiencing a golden age? It's a label his enemies have long attached to him. Now judges at the International Criminal Court in The Hague have issued a warrant for the arrest of Vladimir Putin, which accuses him of being a war criminal. In a statement, the ICC said President Putin and his Commissioner for Children's Rights are suspected of unlawfully deporting thousands of children from Ukraine to Russia during the ongoing war. Here's the President of the Court, Petr Hovmansky.
This is an important moment in the process of justice before the ICC. The judges have reviewed the information and evidence submitted by the prosecutor and determined that there are credible allegations against these persons for the alleged crimes.
So, how momentous is the move by the ICC? Anna Holligan is our correspondent in The Hague in the Netherlands, the home of the court.
I'm actually outside the ICC now. I have been speaking to the prosecutor, Karim Khan. This is a hugely symbolic move, but he says it goes much further than this. And when I asked him whether there was any realistic possibility of President Putin actually ending up on trial here in The Hague, he said, well, look at history. And he pointed to a number of other world leaders who have ended up actually behind bars. So he is optimistic this can happen. And it's actually really interesting that the court has chosen to focus on the deportation of children, because as we know, since the start of the Russian invasion, there have been allegations of many war crimes, crimes against humanity. And yet this one is very specific, focusing on Russia's alleged movement of children from Ukraine across the border into Russia. And Russia has in the past talked about this openly and said that it's being done for humanitarian reasons. Ukraine estimates around 16,000 Ukrainian children have been forcibly transferred into Russia. And under the Rome Statute, the document which underpins the ICC constitutes a war crime, which is why Karim Khan, the prosecutor, has decided to issue these arrest warrants.
Well, other arrest warrants followed, you think, perhaps including crimes like the killing of civilians?
Karim Khan has visited Ukraine four times since the start of the invasion. And during his last visit, he shared a photograph of him inside a children's home surrounded by empty cots. He told me today, children can't be treated as the spoils of war. But he also talked about some of the other alleged atrocities which have been committed, the targeting of civilian infrastructure, for example, hospitals, power grids, water supplies. Anything that's not part of the military operation is unlawful. So it's quite probable, in fact, that more arrest warrants will be issued. But for now, they're focusing on this one. And the prosecutor says he is driven by the evidence. And that's what really matters here, because they're keen that this is not seen as some kind of symbolic or political move. It's based on the evidence they have managed to gather from Ukraine.
But what power does the ICC actually have? I mean, it can't arrest people, can it?
Very good question. Russia is not a member of the ICC. So the reason the ICC is able to investigate is because Ukraine gave the court temporary jurisdiction. Russia is unlikely to surrender any suspects to face trial. But what this will mean, the implications are, every member state is obliged to arrest any wanted suspects if they travel onto their territory. So all of the countries that are signed up to the ICC are now obliged to arrest President Putin if he travels there. So it will, in fact, turn him into something of an international pariah and make travel extremely difficult in the short term. Long term, there is a possibility, the prosecutor says, he will one day end up here in The Hague.
Anna Holligan. So, what reaction to the ICC arrest warrants has there been in Moscow? Olga Ivshina is from the BBC Russian service.
Oh, there was quite some reaction. It also depends which side you're talking about. So Russian officials have reacted promptly. The spokesperson for Russian Foreign Ministry said Russia is not a member of Rome Statute, which means it doesn't have to follow the decisions of ICC, and it doesn't mean anything for Russia. A former president of Russia and currently the head of the Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, went even further and posted an emoji of toilet paper saying that you know what to do with this paper, referring to the decision of ICC. If we talk about the other side of the spectrum, about Russian opposition, they were quite cheerful and they reacted with posts like, wow, amazing, this should have been done quite a while ago. So they were quite supportive of the case.
But do you think, in a way, this might play into what President Putin is telling his people, that the West are against us and everybody is our enemy?
Yes, absolutely. They're going to use that line. We need to remember that from the very beginning of the invasion, this idea that Russia is saving children of Donbas was the main propaganda slogan.
Olga Ivshina from the BBC Russian service. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner examines the wider implications of Friday's development.
No amount of angry dismissal by Russia's leaders can change the fact that these arrest warrants are acutely embarrassing for the Kremlin and for President Putin in particular. Are we about to see the former KGB man standing in the dock in The Hague? No, not a chance. Russia doesn't recognise the ICC and it's hardly about to hand over its all-powerful leader. But the branding of President Putin as a suspected war criminal by a neutral pan-national body like the ICC, which has prosecuted plenty of hideous atrocities in the past, shows it does not accept Moscow's repeated denials. This is important when it comes to the information war, as Russia strives to convince much of the world that it's waging a noble war of self-defence. Having a president who's now a wanted war crime suspect, accused of overseeing the forced abduction of thousands of Ukrainian children, makes that narrative a lot harder to believe.
Frank Gardner. There were renewed concerns about the health of parts of the banking sector on Friday, despite recent multi-billion dollar bailouts of two troubled institutions, the American bank First Republic and the European lender Credit Suisse. Shares in both banks fell and stock markets in the US, UK, France and Germany have edged lower. Our North America business correspondent Samira Hussein is in New York. I asked her about concerns that the banks haven't recovered despite big injections of cash.
In the United States, we saw something pretty extraordinary. We saw that 11 different banks have all pooled a sum of money and have lent it to another bank, First Republic. And this was really done to shore up the bank, but also to shore up confidence in the wider banking system. That doesn't seem to have convinced people on Wall Street. If you look at the way that markets have been trading, there's still a real sense of nervousness.
Is there concern about the health of the entire banking system?
Absolutely. And all of it is really just about this idea of contagion. Part of the reason why you're seeing all of this trouble with First Republic, it all started with the banking crisis that began last week when you saw that U.S. regulators took control over two U.S. banks. That spooked everyone, and investors were thinking, okay, well, now which bank is going to be next? As a result, you're seeing so much pressure on these smaller regional banks like First Republic.
So what are the authorities likely to do now?
Well, now it's really up to what happens next in terms of investor sentiment, how investors feel, and also looking forward, it's really about interest rates. So we saw that the ECB this week said they're going to raise interest rates by half a percentage point as planned. Next week, the U.S. Federal Reserve, America's central bank, will be meeting, and I think a lot of people are paying close attention to see what exactly they will do, whether they will stay the course or if they will make a change in terms of interest rates.
Samira Hussein. A few weeks ago, the FBI concluded that the COVID pandemic was most likely caused by a leak in a biolab in the Chinese city of Wuhan. More recently, a former director of the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Robert Redfield, told a U.S. congressional committee hearing that he'd come to the same conclusion. That claim has never been substantiated, but there's concern that the number of labs handling deadly germs has multiplied, and they may not all be secure. Dr. Philippa Lentzos is based at King's College here in London and has written a report on the issue. And she's been speaking to Owen Bennett-Jones.
Biolabs in and of themselves are not worrying. They're there to make sure we work safely with dangerous bacteria and viruses. The worry is there's lots more of these now being built. The key concern is really that there are some risks that come with building these labs. There are risks about safety, risk to security, risk about potential dual use. How many of these labs do we really need?
Can you just explain to us why more are being built? I mean, who's building them and why?
Most of the labs are for public health purposes. There are some labs that are for defense purposes. There are some labs that are academic research labs. We're now seeing a boom in these labs following the pandemic.
And most of them in what, the West or in Asia? Where are they?
Most of the labs that are now being built are not being built in the places where they have traditionally been built. They're being built in Asia. They're being built in places that don't have the biosecurity, biosafety frameworks, the legal frameworks in place to make sure that work with these pathogens is being done safely, securely and responsibly.
And you talked about dual use and defence. So some of them are being used to create, well, biological weapons, basically.
No, they're not being used to develop biological weapons. In order to find out what you need to defend yourself, you, to some extent, need to create those weapons. But I think that is much less of a concern than what we're seeing in sort of general high-risk biological research, where you are manipulating dangerous pathogens to make them even more dangerous.
Why do you do that, then?
You're making dangerous pathogens more dangerous in order to see what might be coming on the horizon, what pandemic might be hitting us next. Not everyone finds that argument convincing, myself included. And I think there are other means in which we can better prepare for future pandemics and outbreaks.
I get it. So this is basically what the Wuhan lab was doing in China. And as I said at the beginning in the introduction, it's not clear what happened there and whether there was a leak there or not. This is the sort of area you're talking about.
Yes. And of course, it's not just the Wuhan Institute of Virology that was doing these kinds of experiments. There are experiments like this in our own country, in facilities across the world. But what we're really trying to show is to step away from this picture that all of these facilities look like the Wuhan facility and are doing dangerous research like the Wuhan facility. Lots of these facilities are just there for doing medical analysis, diagnostics labs, essentially. It's really to get a sense of, well, how many of these labs are there? What are they working on? Who are they funded by? To map this space and get a sense of what the field looks like.
I guess the difficulty is that if you're working in one of these labs, it must be so easy to catch an illness from materials you're working with. And then as soon as you've walked out of the lab, you're a problem.
Which is why you build containment facilities, why you build these labs. It's to make sure you introduce practices, protocols to operate safely in these labs. So that's all aspects of biosafety, which is relatively well developed. And that's one of the things that we're seeing with the new labs being built, primarily in Asia. They don't have that regulatory framework in place. And so that is one of the real concerns. And we're hoping that by drawing attention to this, it will encourage those countries to make sure they have their legislation in place once those labs are finally operating.
Dr. Philippa Lentzos speaking to Owen Bennett-Jones. India's recent victories at the Academy Awards, winning Oscars for Best Original Song and Documentary Short, have given a big boost to the country's film industry. Oscar night demonstrated to a global audience how India is forging a new, vibrant form of escapist cinema and that its documentary sector is also rapidly developing. From Los Angeles, Tom Brook reports.
Natu Natu, an exuberant musical number from the Telugu language epic action drama RRR, winning for Best Original Song, was a sweet victory for India, bringing forth jubilation in Hollywood and India. The movie, one of the most expensive Indian films ever made, has become a huge international hit, grossing around $160 million worldwide. Its director, S.S. Rajamouli, was a very happy man.
I make movies for Indians in India and across the globe, but the kind of reception it had in America or in the Western world is something that has been never been achieved by any other Indian film ever.
RRR isn't Mumbai-centered Hindi-language Bollywood cinema. It's a movie in Telugu from Tollywood in South India. And the Oscars endorsement on top of the film's box office success is giving Hollywood a bit of a wake-up call, showing there are other ways of bringing audiences film fantasy. RRR is an anti-colonialist drama set in 1920s India, the story of the relationship between two heroes, packed with action, musical numbers, and numerous computer-generated wild animals. It's impressed IndieWire chief film critic Eric Cohn in New York.
There's something about RRR that's appealing to people that goes beyond kind of the parameters of South Asian cinema. And also, I think a lot of audiences are starved of good escapism. We have so many Marvel movies, we have so many Star Wars movies. That sort of storytelling has started to feel kind of redundant. This is an original big spectacle, and it's just really exciting to see that in a movie theater setting.
India's other Oscar night victory was for The Elephant Whisperers, a story set in a rescue camp for orphaned elephants, which won for Best Documentary Short. And India was also nominated for its feature-length documentary, All That Breathes, the story of two brothers who care for black kite birds which drop every day from Delhi's smog-polluted skies. It was directed by Shaunat Sen.
It's an ecological, socio-political and a kind of emotional story around Delhi through the relationship of two brothers, these two Muslim men, and this one particular bird of prey, this raptor called the black kite. And through it, we unravel these kinds of different currents of the city ecologically, socio-politically and emotionally.
And All That Breathes director Shaunat Sen thinks that India's documentaries getting Oscars recognition by way of a trophy or a nomination shows the country's non-fiction film movement is really developing.
There is a moment right now where Indian docs, especially in the last few years, have done very well. Filmmakers have gone and really learned the ropes in terms of how to work the industry, how to secure the resources, and in terms of film grammar, really. Having said that, I don't want to have a kind of simple-minded, euphoric optimism about this moment. We're still completely bogged down by a ton of problems of infrastructure. So I'm cautiously and very guardedly optimistic.
RRR and The Elephant Whisperer's victories could mark a turning point, the beginning of a new era in which Indian cinema is more enthusiastically celebrated on the global stage.
Tom Brook. Now, before we move on with news of the Happy Pod this weekend, here's Andrew Peach.
Yes, the Happy Pod is half an hour of the happiest news stories in the world, and you'll find them here every Saturday. There's a big tech story this week about using a data centre to heat a swimming pool for free. I've been talking to the man at the centre of it about how he had the idea in a pub and how his idea might change how we heat lots of things. There are academic studies about happiness published pretty much every week. Going to hear from the oldest this weekend at Harvard University in Massachusetts. They've been working on it since 1938. And we've got many more of our listeners with the sounds that make them happy this week from Berlin, Tallahassee, Vienna and Mexico City. Do get involved. Send me your happy news, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And join me, Andrew Peach, for the Happy Pod this weekend.
Andrew Peach, putting a smile on your face. Still to come in the Global News Podcast.
I was not feeling good in myself, so I knew something drastic needed to happen. And it was just a real, like, epiphany moment. I looked down the coast and I just thought, just walk the UK coast.
How that decision has completely changed the fortunes of a former British soldier. Opposition parties in France have tabled two no-confidence motions against the government. It comes a day after President Emmanuel Macron used a technical mechanism to force a controversial pension reform bill through Parliament without a vote, a decision that brought protesters out on the streets. I asked our correspondent Hugh Schofield in Paris if these motions would make any difference.
We'll have to see. The procedure is quite clear. He's just using a possibility in the Constitution for Parliament to pass a law without a vote. The quid pro quo of which is that there's a vote of confidence, essentially, in the government if it's tabled by the opposition. The measure has not gone through yet. It will go through if these censure motions early next week fail. So what we have now is two censure motions, one which has been laid by the far right and another which has been laid by a small centrist group which has the support of the far left. Now, the one on the far right won't pass because the far left will never vote for the far right. The one by the centrist group has much more of a chance because That will attract the votes of the far right and the far left. And so the numbers are going up then. And what they have to do is reach the halfway mark, which is 287, I think. And there, I think they're about 30 off that. So it depends a lot, once again, on the Conservative Party, the Republicans Party, to see how many of them are prepared to vote for this censure motion. I think probably it won't get through them. That certainly seems to be the consensus, in which case it'll fail, and in which case life goes on, the measure becomes law, and you just have a very divided country behind all of that.
And a lot of demonstrations. I mean, are more protests and strikes planned against Mr. Macron's plan to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64?
I mean, right now, it kicked off again at the Place de la Concorde. If you remember this time yesterday, there was a spontaneous demonstration there by about 2,000 or 3,000 people, which ended up with the police having to intervene because fires were started and it turned nasty. Almost exactly the same pattern is being repeated there tonight. I'm just watching the pictures a few minutes ago, and the police are again preparing to move in because certain elements, shall we say, are using it to vandalise. There's works going around the obelisk in the middle of the Place de la Concorde, and they're threatening to set fire to that. So there and in other places, there is going to be more trouble. And then next Thursday, there's a day of strikes and demonstrations again. And it just remains to be seen whether this gathers momentum or whether, as the government certainly hopes, it sort of starts losing momentum now when people realise, well, we put up a good fight, but this is going to become law.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. A court in the Pakistani capital Islamabad has suspended an arrest warrant for the main opposition leader Imran Khan that had prompted fierce clashes between his supporters and police earlier this week. The former prime minister faces charges relating to his failure to declare the profits he made from selling gifts he received from foreign countries while he was in office. Mr. Khan is also facing dozens of other charges, including ones connected to rioting and terrorism. Our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davis reports.
Music, dancing and flags outside Lahore's High Court. Inside, Imran Khan had been given bail, but that's not the only reason they were celebrating. In a court in Islamabad, the warrant for his arrest had been suspended after Mr. Khan assured the authorities that he would attend court on Saturday. It was this warrant that the police were trying to enforce when they arrived at Mr. Khan's home on Tuesday to arrest him. The clashes between officers and Khan's supporters left injured on both sides. Although the police operation was suspended, crowds of his supporters have stayed by Mr. Khan's side.
Many people we've spoken to here travelled for hours and have stayed for days to come and support Mr. Khan, and they are adamant that they will continue to stay here because they feel he needs their protection.
We're not afraid of death, we're with Imran Khan, this supporter shouts.
I come here since last 1 month, and we will be there, whatever the condition is, we will be there, we will stand behind him like a rock.
He's a fantastic guy, he's an honest guy. We cannot take risk like leader like him, and we as a worker, we don't want to allow him to come out from the home, but as per rule, he will definitely come to the court as he came today. Till our last breath and till our last drop of blood, we'll save him.
Mr. Khan and his party have said the reason why he hasn't appeared in court recently is because he isn't safe. Opponents say he's using his supporters as a human shield to avoid the law. Now all eyes are on Islamabad and Mr. Khan's next long-awaited court appearance.
Caroline Davis. A new report by the Global Commission on the Economics of Water warns that demand for fresh water will outstrip supply by 40% by the end of this decade. It highlights water wastage, particularly in rich countries, as a cause of what it says is an approaching crisis worldwide. One of the report's lead experts is Professor Joyita Gupta from the Amsterdam Institute for Social Science Research. Paul Henney asked her if the problem of demand for water outstripping supply is new.
It's not new. We've had many cities worldwide that have faced day zero, a day when there is no water in the taps. We've had many basins that have reached a closed status, which means that the demand for the water in that river basin is higher than the water that is there. And of course, in relation to groundwater, we are pumping out groundwater faster than it's recharging. And that means that we've had this problem for quite some time now, but it is becoming a global scale problem.
Of course, there are parts of the world where there is no water shortages. The temperate areas tend to be the richer areas. Does the report highlight them as using too much water?
Well, it's not just about too much water. It's about some places in the world have too little, some places have too much when we're talking in terms of floods, and some places have a lot of polluted water. So in the richer countries in the world, we also see massive pollution of surface water and groundwater, as well as we see occasionally that the groundwater is dropping very low. We see that rich countries also face the problem of infrastructure breakdown. So the pipes are breaking down in the United States for drinking water services. So you see a lot of trouble in the rich countries, but you also see it in the developing world.
Now, you say that one trend is countries growing increasingly nervous about sharing water. That sounds ominous.
Yes, and you see, the problem is that if we see water as scarce, and in fact, through the history of humankind, countries have begun to collaborate with each other because of the scarcity, but they've also begun to not to collaborate with each other because of the scarcity. And in fact, in 2015, countries said in the 2030 agenda that they would like to have full permanent sovereignty over their resources. So this is a bit frightening that countries don't want to share their water. But it is really important that we try to create a call for collective action to ensure that we understand that the global hydrological system is a common shared commodity, a global common good for all of us.
Do you have any optimism that that will happen, greater cooperation, just in a phrase or two?
I don't know. You know, in 2015, we were quite surprised that we were able to get together 17 goals from the international community. So, you know, a cooperation at the global level goes up and down. And the question is whether next week at this water conference, whether we will be able to get that momentum forward, that countries are actually willing to think about this. I'm hoping that common sense will prevail.
Professor Joyita Gupta. In Thailand, police are to be subject to random spot check mental health assessments, and the public will be encouraged to report any officers who appear to be mentally unwell. I asked Nopon Wong Anan from our Thai service why.
Because just the incident just happened earlier this week when a police officer started firing guns into the public from his house, and that took 27 hours of this seizure to stop. Luckily, nobody was killed except the police officer who was taken out in a storm into his house, and then there were gunfires that happening, and then he got hit by several bullets and he died in hospital. There was one officer who was also shot during the raid as well, but luckily a helmet that protect them. But that was an alarm for the public because a recent incident happened just last year, and that one killed more than 30 children in a school.
And this happened. A police officer too?
It was. So that kind of like raised the awareness that officers with firearms could cause an incident more than general public. And people who are working in the police force tend to have more stress than ordinary people. So stressful people with firearms, that could cause a lot of trouble.
And how have the police reacted to this news that there are going to be these spot checks?
This law was announced just yesterday, but it's too early to say the reaction from them. But in general, the public welcome this because often, even in ordinary life, you see sometimes police officers, after work, they carry gun, have a few drinks, and what could happen?
And what are the public going to be advised to look out for?
They are advised to, if they spot some police officers who may seem to have some mental health issues, they can report this to a hotline, to a website that the police has recommended.
People listening to this might think, well, the Thai authorities should be fussier about who they recruit into the police at the beginning, and they should look out for mental health problems before these policemen are out on the streets.
Yes and no. When they first recruit, you can be ordinary people like you and I, but the workload, the stress that they have, or challenges that they've been through, that could then change them into something else as well. And especially with this particular case that just happened, people are also saying that he might have been allegedly abused by his colleagues, harassed, and then maybe unfairly treated by his boss as well. So that could turn him as an ordinary nice person into somebody else.
Nopon Wong Anan from our Thai service. A former British soldier is nearing the end of an incredible personal journey that's lasted nearly 6 years and covered nearly 14,000 kilometres. Chris Lewis is walking around the coast of Great Britain, including the offshore islands, raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for charity. Along the way, he's written a book, adopted a dog, and met his girlfriend, who recently gave birth to their son. Richard Hamilton has been talking to him.
Chris Lewis served in a British Army parachute regiment, but afterwards he found it hard to adapt to civilian life, and he struggled with mental health issues and homelessness. Then in August 2017, he made a life-changing decision.
I'd been suffering with anxiety and depression for quite a while. I was also a single parent, and when my daughter was old enough, she kind of flew the nest, and by this point I was not feeling good in myself, so I knew something drastic needed to happen. And it was just a real, like, epiphany moment, if you like. I just came out from a surf and I looked down the coast and I just thought, do you know what, just walk the UK coast. And literally 2 days later, I was gone.
Chris set off with a tent on his back and £10 in his pocket. He learnt to forage from the land and rely on the kindness of strangers who would offer him food, a drink or a bed for the night. In 2018, he adopted a dog called Jet, who's walked beside him ever since. He'd been a single man for 10 years, but then something extraordinary happened.
I lived on an uninhabited island off the west coast of Shetland for the first lockdown. Just as the lockdown had finished, I came back to mainland Scotland and I walked down these steps right down to the bottom of these sea cliffs. And about an hour and a half into me being there, Kate sort of stumbled down. She was on her own solo adventure doing wild camping across Scotland for a week. And yeah, I just happened to meet her on my last night and we just spent the whole night chatting. We kept in touch, and 6 weeks later, Kate gave up everything and said, can I come with you? And we started together then.
And you've now got a little son that you take on the walk as well.
Magnus was born on the 1st of May last year, and it was the best decision we ever made. You know, Magnus is such a little bundle of joy. He's always happy and he's thriving outside and he's always healthy. He's never ill. It's a great little team that we've got.
Chris, Kate, Magnus and Jet are now nearing the end of their journey and hope to finish in 3 months' time. Chris has acquired a huge following on social media and many of his fans have donated to SAFA, a charity that supports military veterans and their families. So far, they've raised more than $360,000. It's a remarkable story of a man who's literally walked himself to happiness.
Ah, oh, Richard Hamilton there. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.